15-minute warning.
May it please the court. This is an APA rule challenge to an administrative rule that allows the federal government to operate immigration family detention centers as general residential operations under Chapter 42 of the Human Resources Code. That rule is substantively valid because the facilities fall squarely within the text of the definition of a GRO, and because the division has ample authority to craft exceptions to the statewide exceptions for GROs for particular circumstances, and it is procedurally valid because the adoption order adequately responds to all of the comments received during notice and comment rulemaking. What this case is not about, what it cannot be about, is federal immigration policy or the equities of any individual immigration proceeding. And I say that because the alleged injury for standing for all of the plaintiffs is tied to the fact and duration of immigration detention. And that is something that is, under the Constitution, firmly in the hands of the federal government. By contrast, in this case, the legal issues are all about the benefits of state regulation, something that the district court twice found, as a matter of fact, was beneficial and promoted the welfare of the children in these facilities. And it's that dichotomy between alleged federal harm and proven state benefit that means that none of these plaintiffs have standing to advance their Administrative Procedure Act claims. So I'd like to talk about standing, substantive validity, and then procedural validity. Standing. We have three sets of plaintiffs. Ms. Valenzuela is the easiest to deal with. On page 543 of the clerk's record, she expressly disclaims any concrete injury from this rule and says that she merely disagrees with the policy. So that leaves the residents and grassroots. The residents are not harmed per se by the mere fact of regulating these facilities. In fact, they are, as the district court twice found, benefited by the incremental improvement in the general conditions of the facilities wrought by imposition of regulation. To the extent that any of them have alleged harm, and all of the federal district court precedent on which appellees rely for standing, those have to do with the fact and duration of detention. But once again, that's something that the state doesn't do. The state is not detaining any of these residents. The state has merely adopted an administrative rule that allows it to go in, go through the investigative process, determine whether the facilities meet the requirements for a regulated facility, and then exercise its regulatory control over that facility that includes requiring the facility to self-report violations of state law and post those violations publicly on the internet. And
so what kind of plaintiff would have standing?
Well, certainly the facilities would have standing to challenge the rules in any event, if they had brought a lawsuit to challenge them. And I think it's arguable that if a resident were in the facility for long enough for the litigation process to go through, there's no doubt that under federal or state court jurisprudence, they would have standing to challenge the conditions of confinement while in that facility. But the law is well established that if you change facilities, or if you're released from confinement, you no longer have standing to challenge the conditions of that confinement.
So being released, the contingent release equivalent of mm-hmm. a bond or something like that is still not considered confinement, at least not for the purpose, or detention, not confinement, for the purposes of conferring standing in this kind of a case?
That's our understanding of Williams versus Laura. Okay. And it goes to the point that there's no redress that's going to make them better. And I want to add, too, there is no allegation, nor is there anything in the record that suggests that any person has ever been released from one of these facilities and gone back to that facility.
Well, but a bond is still, there's still a, it's confinement for certain mm-hmm. liberty purposes, agreed?
I do agree, but that gets to the cleavage between federal responsibility and state responsibility in this legal framework. You know, it would be a different question if the state were issuing the orders of detention. It would be more like 54011 of the Family Code, which governs when the state takes children into custody for violations of the Juvenile Justice Code and expressly says, backed up by specific provisions in DPS's administrative rules that if a child, which is defined as only between 10 and 17, is being held only for immigration purposes, then they are not to be held by a Texas facility. That provision does not apply to federal detention. It's a completely separate legal issue. And what they're basically trying to do is strike at the federal government over Texas's shoulder in an APA rulemaking proceeding. And that's why their alleged injuries are not redressable. And it is our position that you need to have, and under Valquinta, that's this court's case law. If you don't have constitutional standing, you can't bootstrap yourself into the APA process.
I will want to ask Ms. Moore the same question, but what, if any, evidence do you believe there is in the record as to these specific named individuals of their status post-release? Was that developed at all, their immigration status post-release, the conditions of the release, the extent to which they might be subject to being detained again, any surrounding questions like that?
Well, everyone agrees that they're no longer in the facility. However, their immigration status, as much of the federal decision-making process that's at issue here, is a black box to us. It's not in the record. You know, the federal agreements, the federal immigration orders, none of that has been advanced into the record. And so I don't actually have a record-based answer for you.
Your answer would be, we know they're no longer detained in the facility. Beyond that, we have no idea.
That's all we know from this record, yes. Okay. And finally, Grassroots concedes on page 1142, paragraph 54 of the record, that their only interest in this is pure advocacy, and their injury is the diversion of advocacy funding to this lawsuit. And that's not a redressable injury. If you can just say my political interests give me the ability to bring this lawsuit, you'd be defeating the very purpose of standing in the first place. I'd like to go through substantive and procedural validity also. The GRO rule 748.7 is substantively valid under the definitions of GRO because GRO is defined in a three-step process. And I think it's important to point out that their brief ignores the middle step. And it ignores the order of the definition in 42.002. Child care is defined as a list of terms that include food, shelter, care, medical care. And then a child care facility is further defined by a number of children held in a certain condition for a certain amount of time. So a GRO is now a place that keeps more than seven children for more than 24 hours at a time. So you get through those two pieces, and then the Chapter 42 carves out certain exceptions from regulation. So it is meant to spread the net widely, and then the legislature has carved it back for specific, some of them quite broad, exceptions from regulation. And so there's just nothing to the argument that the facilities are not providing child care within any meaning of the statute, because child care is defined as this laundry list of things that you can do for children. And that's backed up, if you look at Chapter 748 of what is now Chapter 26 of the Administrative Code, the subheading, there's a subchapter that says child care, and it's all things like nutrition, hours of sleep, dental care, access to medical care. The very things that this record shows facilities are providing to the children. You know, they've raised an argument that there can't be exceptions to the general standards and that you have to have a working group in order to change those standards, and that's simply not true. Section 42.048C and 0.042J provide the division with ample authority to provide case-specific exceptions to the statewide general rules, and that only makes sense. The rules, they're kind of strange rules, right? They're written in an FAQ form, and the reason for that is that the vast majority of these facilities are private homes that are being operated as foster homes for multiple children at a time. And so you'll notice, for instance, the physical facilities rule is written in terms of what you can put in a den or a living room or a hall. You have to be able to tailor those rules that are very kind of specifically written as FAQs for people opening up their homes to children to larger institutional facilities just by the fact that a larger institutional facility doesn't have a family room and a den, as mentioned in the statewide GRO minimum standards. And before I turn to procedural validity, I did want to briefly address 54.011 of the Family Code, which we've talked about a little bit. We don't think it applies at all because it addresses state custody of juvenile delinquents, not the transfer of custody to the federal government when the federal government is detaining immigration status detainees. And the shelter care provisions.
Well, right? Now, status detainees, that's a different meaning than the status offenders in the Family Code.
That's correct.
Okay.
They are different bodies of law.
Right.
Federal status offender is a different standard under the federal immigration law than you would have under 54.011. And the shelter care provisions, likewise, are irrelevant. And I actually think they help to prove the state's case. The shelter rules are for when you have a parent and child together in a homeless shelter or some other shelter that's designed to shelter both of them. That's the only place in Chapter 42 that the legislature has seen fit to distinguish between direct care from the parent and care from another person. If the definition, that, and I think that proves the state's point, if the definition of a GRO required it to exclude direct care by the parent, you would have used the same language that they used in the shelter care provision in the general definitions, but because they didn't, you can't infer a requirement that parents not be providing care into the general definitional provisions of 42.002. And finally, procedural validity. Their procedural validity claim, as we've explained at length in the brief, is based on an outdated view of 2001.033. It is no longer the case that the courts look to the precatory language of the statute and seek to do justice by improving the rules to have the best rules they possibly can. Instead, as this court and the Supreme Court have made clear, the test is whether the rules are substantially in the statutory text, and whether the adoption order adequately addresses each of the comments that were received in notice and comment rulemaking, and our adoption order does. The only way that they can even focus in on our adoption order to make it look perspective-wise, that like it doesn't address the notice and comment process, is to look only at the preface or to look at the statement of emergency rulemaking, which is moot at this point. Because you can't look at just parts of the adoption order in isolation, there is no basis, nothing to their 033 claim. And to sum up, I want to talk about the injunction. Because the injunction, as we've pointed out repeatedly, is a contradiction in terms. The district court wanted to continue what she identified as the benefit to these children of having our investigative power applied. But the statute doesn't say that child care licensing has plenary investigatory power. It says that Child Protective Services has complaint-based power to look at abuse allegations after they happen. The only thing that triggers either the Child Care Licensing Division's ability to investigate prospectively to make sure that conditions are correct under state law, or its ability to look at a specific post hoc complaint that conditions were not maintained, is the issuance of a license. And the only remedy that Chapter 42 conceives of for the state of Texas to help children in these facilities is the suspension or revocation of those licenses. Without the license, there is no regulatory power. So the injunction is erroneous to the extent that, having recognized the regulation is good, it tells the state to go on with the trappings of regulation absent the statutory power to regulate and without any teeth to do anything about that regulation. I've said a couple times, and I will say it again, the district court twice found, as a matter of fact, that the activities of the Child Care Licensing Division were in the interest of these children, that they helped the children in these facilities. That is true of the entire child care licensing scheme as advanced to them. It undercuts their assertion of standing, notwithstanding the mootness issue. And it should put this case in glaring context. Child Care Licensing Division followed the law, and it's doing something that the district court recognized is good for children. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munson.
May it please the court. A state agency cannot go outside its statutory authority, no matter how much it wants to or how good an idea it thinks it is. This agency crossed the line in several ways. But before I go down that list, if the court will indulge me, I want to address an undercurrent in the agency's argument. The agency seems to say, let us off the hook on this case, because if we don't regulate, bad things will happen. These facilities won't be licensed, and the federal government won't be able to comply with the Flores consent decree that it signed. The court should not be seduced by this argument. First, licensing is far from universal in Texas. Clearly, the legislature does not think that licensing is a universal benefit that all should be subject to. It has exempted church schools. It has exempted after-school care. The list goes on. If the agency thinks it's a good idea to license family residential centers, it needs to ask the legislature. The same goes for the federal government. The feds came to the agency, this agency, saying, you have to help us out. We don't like our options. But to the extent the federal government is in a quandary, it is of its own making, as two federal courts have concluded. The federal government is perfectly able to fulfill its legal obligations. And if it doesn't like its current options, it too can seek a legislative fix from Congress or from the Texas legislature. What a Texas state agency cannot do is expand the federal government's options by overstepping the agency's own authority.
And how specifically did the agency expand the federal government's options here?
Your Honor, in three ways. The most obvious is it expanded the government's options, and this goes a bit to standing. And I'll say that the federal government came to Texas with a plea for help, saying, we want to expand our options for detaining these children. We want to detain them longer. You have to help us. And Texas twice, three times, multiple times said, no, we're sorry. We don't have statutory authority to regulate these facilities because parents are there with their children. So it doesn't fall into our statutory authority. When the issue came to a head, finally, in the summer of 2015, with the order from the Flores court, enforcing the agreement against the federal government, saying you can't hold the kids like this anywhere. And so at that point, the federal government came and basically begged Texas. And you know, this agency decided, well, okay, we'll change our mind. We will, you know, we'll help you out.
But I don't hear that you answered a question of how did they expand. I hear
sure.
The lies of what they did, but how did they do it?
Licensing will open the door for the federal government to hold these children for longer periods. Right now, under the Flores order, they're limited to just a few weeks, just enough for processing and to have a screening interview to ensure that there's a credible fear and for asylum.
And that's the result that you may or may not disagree with, that licensing will allow them to hold them for longer. But how did they expand by licensing? So you're saying that the state cannot license at all?
That's right. The state can't license these facilities. And that expands, it allows basically
And because of the reliance on the definitions that are in play here, is that?
The definitions, yes. And so this is the first
way. Before we go there, let me, if you want to answer it, but certainly bear it in mind, I'd like to hear an answer to it, and that is, what is, as to the individuals, let's set aside Ms. Valenzuela, let's set aside Grassroots, as to the individuals, what is the injury that is being inflicted upon the individuals that is traceable to the state of Texas? And the extent to which the record will bear that out.
Yes, there are two injuries. One, the prolonged detention that we were just talking about.
Seems like, and not to cut you off, but I want to keep up with you, I want to say in the state's brief, and certainly take issue with it if you will, but I'm almost certain that I read that the record evidence is the time of detention is actually shorter now.
I can point you to clerk's record 772 and the supplemental clerk's record 829. In those places, both GEO and CoreCivic acknowledge that licensing will enable will make detention times longer, will enable the federal government to detain the kids for the full length of their immigration proceedings, which take years.
And so then, is the potential for doing that and the actual reality of that, or do we need to consider those to be one and the same?
Your Honor, it's the federal government, this is the whole reason we're here. The reason we're here is that Texas is one of two actors that needs to act. The federal government needs to act, and Texas needs to act to make enable the federal government to prolong detention. Without licensing, the federal government can't do it under Flores. It cannot lengthen detention. So the other injury is the conditions of the confinement. Here, what Texas did was lower the minimum standards, specifically by amending the bedroom rules to enable strange adults to sleep in the same room as children. So the private prison companies couldn't or didn't want to comply with the basic minimum standards because they couldn't put as many people in the facilities if that
were
the case.
And we know that they will recite various policy reasons debated apparently and entertained by the state that would support these exceptions, primarily to allow mothers to be in the same room with children. And so is there not in every instance deference that is mandated in that reasoning process, provided that it's rationally related to meeting the objectives of a statute?
We don't contend that the state wasn't allowed to make exceptions. They do have broad discretion in the statute to make exceptions, but we're talking about standing now. We're talking about injury, and this is undoubtedly an injury. If, yes, the kids are in the same room with their mothers, but they're also in the same room with strange adults. Now, the state could have changed the rule to require that parents could be in the same room, that you could be in the same room with your parents without changing it to open that up to any strange adult. So this is an injury that...
It seems to begin to conflict with the order by the court that the court continue its supervisory role. How can you reconcile those two? Well, the state being involved in regulating is infliction of an injury, and so we're going to strip them of the ability to do so by virtue of a rule, but I, the trial court, am going to order the state to continue all those activities minus the licensing aspect of it because that's beneficial for the residents of this facility. Those seem extremely inconsistent with one another.
The important thing to know about that extra piece, which is that the trial court ordered the state to keep inspecting those facilities, is that it was only pending the appeal, only during the pendency of the appeal. It's not a permanent injunction on the state. So what, and the final judgment bears this out, and I think there have occasionally been citations to the temporary injunction. So I want to encourage the court to look only at the final judgment, which is very clear. It grants our summary judgment. So we win on the legal issues. The rule is invalid. But there was in the supersedious portion of the final judgment, and supersedious was contested. This was a hotly contested issue about whether the state was going to be able to supersede and license these facilities. The trial court said, no, I'm not going to let the state supersede. But the trial court also heard this plea from the state that in the interest of the children, it should be allowed to continue to regulate. There was this fear, expression of fear. So that, you know, I think what the trial court did was make a very logical determination. You know, she thought the rule was invalid, and that's what she held. But knowing that this was going to go up on appeal and she might be reversed, in the meantime, she was going to maintain the status quo of the state inspecting. So I think it was a very logical, logical determination. So on to, I want to answer your question, Your Honor. I think this went to both of your questions, Justice Goodwin and Justice Puryear, about the bond, about the conditions under which the women were released. And it's really important to understand that these immigration releases are completely different from releases in the criminal context. So, and does the record show? No, it doesn't. The conditions? No, it doesn't. Because the federal government retains complete authority to detain these women for any reason at its whim. They don't have to do anything. They don't have to commit any crimes. They don't have to do anything. You know, ICE can wake up one morning and say, I'm going to go detain these women again. So, and this is why it's not moot, and this is why Judge Sparks held under identical circumstances that it wasn't moot and under the same situation 10 years ago with the Hutto Center, was that detention remains imminent. So yes, they're not currently detained, but it remains imminent, and that takes it out of mootness. As for substance, so the state from the beginning has had a problem here with fitting the square peg of family residential centers into the round hole of its authority to regulate under Chapter 42, its authority to regulate child care. For 10 years, it said it didn't have authority, and then it had to find somewhere once it decided that it wanted to help out the federal government. So there are three problems here.
And I hate to go back to like an incredibly basic part of this case, but so I understand your argument to be that the state has, I'm sorry, the agency has no authority to enter a rule regulating these facilities, not that the state couldn't convey that ability to the agency to do so, correct?
Exactly right.
So then why do we have to get into the details and the nitty-gritty of what the rule would be? If they have zero authority to issue the rule at all, isn't that just the end of the story?
They have zero authority, yes, to issue this rule. That's exactly right. There are several arguments.
So they have authority to issue a different rule.
Now, they have zero authority because this is not a child care facility, because the state hasn't, the legislature did not give authority over to regulate under licensing places where parents and children stay together. And I will just point out that the legislature knows how to regulate places like this, places with families and children, and at tab 3 of your oral arguments exhibit is section 42.201 of the Human Resources Code. This is regards temporary shelters, family violence shelters, homeless shelters. And here, shelters are defined as, in subsection 1, places designed to provide temporary living accommodations to individuals and families. Families. That is the only place in the Human Resources Code where the legislature gives authority to the state to regulate at all places where families live together. Now, here it was explicit. And it's important to realize that this statute does not grant licensing authority. It's a permit. It's totally separate from the licensing authority over child care centers, over GROs. And this is the section that Judge Spezia referenced in his May letter declining to exercise jurisdiction over Dilley. He pointed to this section and he said, This is the only authority the legislature has given the department over places where parents stay with their children, and it is extremely...
Is there not a distinction between simply a shelter that provides, as the statute puts it, temporary living accommodations and a place that is basically a 24/7 food, water, electricity, cooling, beds, the whole spectrum of necessities for life?
That's a great question, Justice Puryear. And I would point out that Carnes and Dilley have permits to be a temporary shelter. So no, there's no difference. If you read this statute, it reflects almost the exact conditions today at Carnes and Dilley. And in fact, in the record, cancel that. Back to the statute, and it says the only reason that in this 42.201 that the legislature even gave this limited jurisdiction was because the children were being taken care of while, it says in subsection 2C, while the adult described by paragraph A, which is the parent or managing conservator that the kid is with, is away from the shelter. That's the only reason the state requires a permit, not a license, something much less, is because the parent is away from the shelter sometimes. So this shows that the legislature did not intend to extend any licensing reach to places.
What about 42202D, a shelter that provides child care must hold a license to operate a child care facility issued under subchapter C?
Right. This a shelter that provides child care under this section, that refers back if that applies if the shelter is taking kids from outside the shelter, is having operating, if that's more like a regular child care, when they're taking kids from the outside. So in this example, if the kids are only from the shelter, just like at Carnes and Dilley, then it doesn't require a license. And here I will point out 42.207, a shelter daycare facility operating under this subchapter is not a child care facility. So that's pretty clear. It's taking it completely out of the definition of child care that the department relies on for its jurisdiction. And I would also like to point out there's another big problem, and that's the definition of a GRO. Another square peg round hole problem.
Well, isn't that, I mean, the court's judgment zeroes in on 0024, does it not?
It does, Your Honor.
It says it contravenes that definition and runs counter to the general objectives of the statute, whatever we're supposed
yes.
to conclude that means.
And the key here is that in the rule, and the rule is on tab one of your oral argument exhibits, the agency did not apply the statutory definition of a GRO. It rewrote it. It rewrote it in subsection, wait, first, in, well, in subsection A4, it says, so what the, pardon me, what the statute says is that the GRO must care for the children 24/7. And what the rule says is that a parent or family member provides the direct care for the child. So right there, the facility is not providing care 24/7. And then it says, except for specific circumstances when the child is cared for directly by the center or another adult in the custody of the center. And what that means is these specific circumstances when the parent wouldn't be taking care of the child, there's no guarantee that the facility is actually caring for them at that point. It could be this another person in custody at the center. So the rule puts forth the possibility that they're going to license a facility that is not providing any care, that's providing zero care, much less the 24/7 care required by the statutory definition of a GRO.
Well, and that was kind of what I was trying to get to, is why are we worried about the details of the rule if you say that the agency had no authority to issue any rule whatsoever?
Your Honor, you could go either way. You could say that there's no jurisdiction over any place where there is our children and kids
and
together.
Kids.
Or you could go and say, like the trial court did, and say, this conflicts with the statutory definition of a GRO. Or you could go to Section 51.011 of the Family Code and look at this.
Well, but then we have the problem of the state not detaining.
That's not
and
required not, by the statute.
These aren't chins and these aren't status offenders under Texas law.
Your Honor, the text of 54.011 is extremely broad. It does not only apply to, by its terms, it has no restriction on only facilities that are under the Juvenile Justice Code. It applies to any facility, public or private, and it's extremely broad. And it's ironic that here this department, this agency, is venturing out of its wheelhouse into detention of children. So it's encroaching on the territory of another agency or another area of the statutes and licensing, putting its seal of approval on an entity that's detaining children in a secure facility. And it says, but it says it doesn't have to play by the rules of that other group of statutes. So if the department's going to go into this area and license people who are detaining children, it should be incredibly aware of the provisions in the Code of Criminal Justice, where the legislature has said very clearly that you can't detain children in this situation in any facility for any length of time in a secure facility. I see my time is up.
Any other questions? All right, thank you, Ms. Warren.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate the argument.
May it please the court, just a few things to clear up. The first is this bugbear of secure facility. 54.011 does not talk about secure facilities generally. It says secure correctional facilities, which has a specific definition in the Family Code. And it's just completely different from any concept of security relating to GROs. And I would point out, and the record supports this, GROs commonly limit access in and out of the facility because we don't want children kidnapped and we don't want them running away. If that ability to come and leave is the definition of secure, GROs are often secure for that common sense reason. Second, I do want, you're right, Justice Puryear, this was not a general grant of a motion for summary judgment. The grounds were specified on page 4214 of the clerk's record. And so the only question you have to resolve is whether there's a violation of 42.024 and the general objectives of the code. We know that the general objectives of the code are legally irrelevant, and their reading of 42.024 ignores 42.023. And so it's the specified ground for summary judgment just ignores the definitional section of what child care is. Same problem with the shelter rules. They want to import this idea of direct care or child care that is spelled out in the shelter rules, shelter statute and rules, into the general GRO standard, and it just doesn't work that way. To the contrary, the fact that the legislature specified a distinction between facility care and parent care in the shelter care statute suggests that that distinction doesn't make any difference in the general definition of a GRO. As for standing, Grassroots and plaintiffs have cited only the facility's applications for the licenses that hypothetically said that they expected detention to be longer. And in fact, the record reflects at page 3032 of the clerk's record that average times by the time of trial had decreased since the licensure process. 3032, yes. Average time of detention had decreased after the licensure process began. I do think that's relevant to standing. And finally, I want to deal with this idea that there's a marionette string between the Child Care Licensing Division's activities and the Flores decision. Yes, there is some relationship. But if you're looking at standing, which is the first question that it's relative to, if you have to go to another forum to bring another lawsuit and complain against a third party to fix the thing that you're complaining about, that's the opposite of standing. If you're coming into court and saying, my injury is caused because I can't spend money lobbying for this policy outcome that I want, and so will you do it for me? That's not standing. If you're saying, I have been let out of this facility, that there's no evidence, and I don't allege I'm going to go back to, but I don't like the conditions there, and I don't like that these people helped me and made it better, that's not standing.
What about the imminent detention issue?
The fact of detention is tied only to the federal government. So that's one problem. Another problem is when the Hutto Center case was going on, that was the only facility to which they could go back. There is a third facility in Pennsylvania that exists. That's all we know from the record about it. But we do know that there's no allegation and no support in the record for the proposition that anybody has ever been detained and put back in these facilities. So they have standing to assert their statutory rights regarding the immigration removal proceedings. No contest. They can sue and forward their arguments in federal court and say, let me out, let me stay in the United States, I deserve amnesty. We have no problem with that. That's exactly what our legal system allows them to do. What Texas law says you can't do is after you leave a facility, unless you fit into CRIER, the capable of repetition yet evading review, you can't complain about the place that you used to be. And Williams versus Laura says you don't get to look back and bring that lawsuit retrospectively. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Monson. Again, thank both of you. With that, the case will be submitted for consideration, and the court will stand in recess.
All please rise.